Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Average annual economic growth in this country over the past 100 years is just over 3%. But lately, as you might have heard, the U.S. economy has fallen on hard times. So how to explain this morning's report of a 3.3% rise? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Areva, solutions for producing CO2-free energy and transmitting and distributing electricity. Online at us.areva.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is the 28th of August. It's a Thursday, and it is good to have you here. It's also a stretch to call this economy above average, but if you go strictly by the numbers, it is. 3.3% growth for the second quarter beats the historical record by just a little bit. Before you get all excited, though, you should probably listen to Marketplace's John Dimsdale explain why the momentum might not last.
Despite high energy and food prices, a deep decline in housing, and tight credit, the economy jumped ahead last spring. Mark Zandi at Economy.com attributes the growth to
two things. One, the tax rebate checks. Consumers went out and spent them. And a very large, really record improvement in our trade balance, driven by a surge in exports and very weak import growth.
Many economists doubt these trends will last. For one thing, the tax rebate checks have all been spent. Also, economic growth overseas is slowing, reducing demand for U.S. exports. The chief economist for the Manufacturers Alliance, Dan Mextroth, says housing-related industries like construction materials and appliances are already weak, and he's gloomy about the prospects.
We think the economy measured through GDP is going to experience a recession at the end of this year and the first quarter of next year. The rebate checks were able to allow consumers to pay off debt, increase purchases somewhat, but it's a very weak consumption response.
Another bad indicator, profits were weak in the second quarter. Mark Zandi says businesses are getting squeezed between higher prices for raw materials and reluctant consumers.
The sales environment is so tough that they're having to eat some of these higher costs for oil, energy, commodities, and aren't able to pass it through, and it's cutting into their profitability.
Zandi says whether the economy is headed for a recession is a close call, but lower oil prices would help avoid one. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
All the macroeconomic talk today has largely overlooked regular Americans, the people who actually make this economy work. And if there's any doubt that people are still having a tough time, forget what the GDP numbers say. New figures from the U.S. bankruptcy court should take care of that. Nearly a million people and businesses went under in the first half of the year. From New York, Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
Private companies log bankruptcy figures each month. Bob Lawless teaches law at the University of Illinois. He says those figures show that July was packed with bankruptcy filings.
In fact, they were at their highest level since the 2005 bankruptcy law passed, and that kind of violates historical norms where bankruptcy filings stay pretty flat in the summer.
Lawless expects bankruptcies will continue to rise, thanks in part to lost jobs and stagnating wages. Clark Balcom is an attorney in Portland, Oregon. He's seen a sharp uptick in clients seeking to file for bankruptcy this year. He says most earn their living in real estate or construction, like the client who came in a couple of weeks ago.
She'd been a realtor for many, many years, newer stuff, and typically made $100,000 a year or more, and now this year so far, her total income, gross income, has only been a few thousand.
Balcom says more clients than usual have tried to stave off bankruptcy, including undergoing credit counseling. But in the end, he says, they have no other choice. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Tropical storm Gustav is winding toward the Gulf of Mexico. It's expected to turn back into a hurricane by tomorrow. Ordinarily, a storm like that headed straight for the oil rigs in the Gulf would send prices shooting up. But the White House and the International Energy Agency headed the markets off the pass today. They said this morning they'll release emergency stockpiles if needed. That, of course, sent crude back down. Residents of the Gulf Coast are getting ready for the storm, even though we still don't know exactly where it's going to hit. Gustav is on its way as we mark the third anniversary of Hurricane Katrina tomorrow, which is only adding to the stress level in the Gulf states. We got John Pope on the line earlier today. He's a reporter with the New Orleans Times-Picayune, and I asked him what kinds of preparations he sees being made.
Governor Jindal has already declared a pre-storm state of emergency, and he mobilized 3,000 National Guard troops, and with as many as 5,000 possible being called up. And the police chief said that 300 National Guards folks will accompany police to discourage looting. There will also be a curfew once the storm situation comes up, and people who leave their property after curfew will be arrested.
What's your sense? Are people thinking about staying, or are they going to take heed of the lessons of history and hit the road?
In Katrina, one of the big problems was the inability to get out of town, poor people who had no wheels of their own. So 17 sites have been set up to pick up these folks. My wife and I have withdrawn money, and we're going to gas up our cars. People are buying stuff, water mainly, non-perishable.
Are business folks down there planning on sticking around at least as long as they can to keep selling those supplies?
That's the impression I got.
FEMA has said that it's got truckloads of supplies standing by. The American Red Cross is making preparations. Are you seeing any of that in the city proper?
No. This is a very slow-moving storm that's really, frankly, exasperating for those of us who live here. And there's no sense going into disaster mode until there's a better indication of where the storm's going. There is no public panic right now.
John Pope at the New Orleans Times-Picayune. Mr. Pope, thanks a lot.
You're welcome, and thank you.
No panic on Wall Street today either. Traders took one look at those GDP numbers and started buying. Falling oil only added fuel to the fire. We'll have the details when we get the numbers. It's all over but the shouting for the Democrats in Denver. Oh, except for that speech Barack Obama's going to make tonight. Even though it's not like they're going to pass an actual hat, party conventions, both the Democrats and the Republicans are as much about money as they are about anything else. The Politico's Gene Cummings is in Denver. Gene, good to have you here.
Thank you for having me, Kai.
After his big speech tonight, and after John McCain accepts the Republican nomination next week, are those two campaigns going to see a big bump in how much money comes in over the transom?
Well, I'm certain that the Barack Obama campaign is depending on that. He has decided not to take taxpayer money, so he has to raise roughly $50 million a month to meet the kind of budget he has laid out.
That's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money, and it's a lot of money for just the candidate to take on because he's not going to get a lot of help from the Democratic National Committee. They are notoriously not a good fundraising venue, so Barack Obama may have to take some of that precious campaign time and go do some fundraisers, whereas John McCain won't have to do that.
Because the Republican Party is going to be able to help him out in addition to that $84 million that the senator is going to get, right?
Absolutely. And just to illustrate how strong the Republican National Committee remains as a fundraising operation, if you take the combined amount of money that Barack Obama and the DNC have raised and compare it to the RNC and John McCain, there's only $2 million difference between them.
But how much can Obama keep squeezing those small donors who've given 50 or 100 bucks online? He's got to keep going back to that well, doesn't he?
He does, and he does have a lot of room to grow. It is remarkable how small their giving has been, but when you figure there's 2 million of them, if he needs $50 million, each of them could give 20 bucks, and he'd be at 40 million. Now, that's an easy mathematical calculation that doesn't often translate into real-life behavior. And where Barack Obama could really benefit is if Hillary Clinton's big donors, her bundlers, would really get off the fence, because there are many of them that have not.
Are the candidates using these conventions to raise even more money from their donor base?
They are. When Michelle Obama gave her speech on Monday night, Barack Obama pinged out an email praising her speech and at the end was a please donate. So every speech will also be used to help generate cash. In addition, they're doing some grassroots organizing around tonight's speech. And there again, it's an opportunity for them to build the names of supporters that ultimately they hope to convert into donors as well. John McCain and the RNC will do similar things next week.
Is there a way that John McCain can sort of hope to boost his individual money output, or I guess intake is the right word?
Well, where John McCain will play on the fundraising arena in the fall is raising money for the RNC. Under the law, he cannot accept any private donations once he accepts a nomination and collects that check from the taxpayers.
Does that deadline for him about taking private money start literally next Thursday at the Republican convention when he says, I accept your nomination?
It sure does. It's been known to have the check FedExed.
No way, really?
Mm-hmm. Transferred immediately now in the modern age.
Gene Cummings covers money and politics for Politico. We reached her right outside the Pepsi Center in Denver this afternoon. Gene, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
A six-way security meeting in Central Asia wouldn't ordinarily get much attention on this program unless two of the participants were named Russia and China and the invasion of Georgia was on the list of talking points. At just such a meeting today, Russia got some support from its Asian allies, which left China stuck right in the middle. From Shanghai, Marketplace's Scott Tong explains.
China is trying to straddle the fence when it comes to Russia. On one hand, it can't openly endorse Moscow and its backing of Georgian separatists. Michael Herberg is with the Pacific Council on International Policy.
The Georgia issue for the Chinese really smacks of rewarding a secessionist movement, and China is extremely sensitive about national unity, infringement of sovereignty, and secessionist movements.
Movements like breakaway Tibet. But on the other hand, China can't offend Russia or its Central Asian allies also at today's summit. All those countries have what China wants, oil and gas. And the world is running out of places with energy potential. Here's economist Kang Wu of the East-West Center in Honolulu.
The growth area will be Middle East, Russia, Central Asia, Africa, and that's it. Other areas are declining. Latin America is declining, U.S.
That reality has China investing billions in pipelines across the former Soviet Union. The hope is they'll bring large amounts of oil from Siberia and Kazakhstan and natural gas from Turkmenistan. David Zweig is with the Hong Kong University for Science and Technology. He says China is trying to diversify its sources.
China relies greatly on the Middle East, which is relatively unstable, so it would like to find greater political stability and sees the pipeline as an alternative to bringing oil across the high seas.
The fact is, China has to go wherever the available hydrocarbons are. Sudan, Iran, Venezuela. Beijing takes heat for all those dealings. And the risk is Russia could become its next messy entanglement. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up, South Africa does a cost-benefit analysis on its biggest inhabitants.
The bottom line is a live elephant brings in much more money in a much more sustainable way than a dead one.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials jumped 1.8% today, 212 points to finish at 11,715. The Nasdaq grew 1.25%, 29 points to close at 2411. The S&P 500 shot up 1.4%, 18 points, made the day at an even 1,300. Seems like it's becoming a regular thing when we do the numbers. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac saw huge gains again today. Shares of Fannie leaped 22% on news of a management shakeup. Freddie vaulted 11%. Lehman Brothers offered the most recent endorsement of the twin mortgage finance firms. Speaking of Lehman, it added more than 7% today as investors got rich on financial stocks. Wachovia and Washington Mutual each tacked on almost 10%. Merrill Lynch was good for a 9% gain. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.78% today. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Want more from Marketplace? It's all on our website. You can stream, download, or subscribe to podcasts of all our shows. And we have text of most stories, plus special reports and the Marketplace Toolbox. Check it out at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for July. The University of Michigan's final report on consumer sentiment for August is released. And it's the anniversary of a memorable day in rock. The Beatles played their final live concert on August 29, 1966 in San Francisco. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. A federal appeals court gave the Justice Department a slap on the wrist today. The court dismissed tax fraud charges against former executives at the accounting firm KPMG. The judges ruled the government improperly tried to pressure the firm into not paying those executives' lawyers' bills. In the first couple of years after Enron, there was a crackdown on corporate misbehavior, like tax fraud. But after much complaining by businesses and some unintended consequences, today the government agreed to change how it goes after companies in trouble. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports now from North Carolina Public Radio.
If you're a company under federal investigation, working with prosecutors can keep you from getting indicted. But under the old Justice Department guidelines, cooperating often meant dissing your employees. Companies like KPMG were penalized for paying workers' legal fees. The practice was unfair, says Columbia Law professor John Coffey.
That was a way of trying to force the defendant into a plea of guilty because he couldn't personally pay the cost of his own counsel.
Under the new rules, prosecutors can't consider whether a company's paying for their employees' legal fees when deciding whether it's cooperating. And the Justice Department is forbidden from asking corporations to spill the beans on attorney-client discussions. UC Berkeley law professor Eric Talley says the new rules could lead to more corporate fraud convictions because workers will feel the company's got their back.
They may be more willing to cooperate and more willing to speak freely with federal investigators.
But the new rules could open the door to abuse. Professor James Cox at Duke University says companies could prepare an internal report that documents their innocence. Then, when the Justice Department wants to see it,
the response by the corporation is to say, oh, no, I'm sorry, that's protected by the attorney-client privilege, and we can't show that to you. So you don't know whether the report is, one, legitimate, or two, just a highly paid-for whitewash.
But business doesn't think the guidelines go far enough. It wants a law that lays out the rules. The new guidelines from the Justice Department may be an attempt to head off that legislation. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
If you really want to know how business works, for good or for bad, and you've got a couple of years to spare, you might want to think about getting an MBA. More people are doing exactly that. The Graduate Management Admission Council says MBA applications are up this year. That means more students are about to be assigned to read a bunch of business case studies. Enron, for example, would be a classic case study of corporate malfeasance. Joel Podolny's the dean of the Yale School of Management. Professor Podolny, good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
For those of us who haven't had the joys of an MBA program or a legal education for that matter, remind us what the case study method is, would you?
So the case study method goes way back within business schools, almost to the 1920s was where it started. A case is usually about a 10 to 15 page brief on some topic or managerial problem with sort of 5-10 exhibits at the end. And it's used to facilitate a discussion of some particular issue. The faculty member will lead 90 students through the discussion.
Now, there has to be a better way in this day and age than making some poor student sit down with 15 or 20 pages and a bunch of exhibits and try to slog his way through it. What are you doing at Yale that's sort of changing the paradigm a little bit?
Over the last basically year and a half, we've been pioneering what we call sort of the raw case method. We use that terminology to distinguish it from the more traditional sort of cooked case, which, as I just said, it's sort of a prepackaged brief. What distinguishes the raw case format is that it really pulls together in a web portal all the raw documentation that would be relevant to a managerial situation. Not only is this way of presenting data more consistent with the way in which the students will actually have to process information in the real world, it's also more consistent with how they learn and bring in material. I mean, the students who are coming to us today, they've learned to gather knowledge in a hyperlinked world, and that's really the way in which we're presenting that information to them.
So let's do a hypothetical or create a case study, I guess, just kind of on the fly here. I mean, if you were going to put something together to explain the subprime squeeze or the woes of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, what might that look like in a raw case study?
Well, it's interesting that you would bring that up as an example. We actually have a collaboration with the Wall Street Journal where we're trying to put together precisely that. So you might have one that would focus on what has happened at Bear Stearns, and you would put together the print chronology. You would also bring together the financials of Bear Stearns. There would be interviews that could be on the radio, interviews that would be on television shows, and so on. All that would be assembled, as well as any of the legal documents that needed to be filed. And that would be one piece. But then there might be another, which would show the students about the drive to increase home ownership as sort of the initial underpinnings of the subprime crisis, again, relying on raw documentation, legal documentations as well.
Have you had anybody who has been the creator of some of this data that you're putting in there come to you and say, wait a minute, this is my intellectual property, and here you are profiting from it?
Right now, the economic model is actually less important to us. We have been in a position where all the material that we use entirely within the context of the School of Management. We make sure to get licensing rights for everything. In order for the cases that we develop at the Yale School of Management to be used broadly, there's going to need to be sort of clear procedures for how one obtains licensing. And honestly, I think one of the things that is most exciting to us is the possibility that this format lends itself to an open collaboration in the same way in which, for example, Wikipedia builds topics. You could imagine this raw case format doing the same for the way business cases are being created.
Joel Podolny is the dean at the Yale School of Management. We'll have links to some of those raw cases that he was talking about on our website. It's marketplace.org. Professor Podolny, thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thanks for having me.
Today, Indonesia announced new protections for two of the world's endangered species. The government's going to double the size of a national park that's home to the Sumatran tiger and elephant. But they might want to be just a little bit careful about how they set up their wildlife management plan in case they're too successful. The African elephant is a protected species, and in the wild, populations are dwindling. But inside South Africa's nature reserves, herds are growing. So the government's come up with a new plan, one with an eye toward the bottom line. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Gretchen Wilson reports.
Kruger National Park is a wide expanse of African bush, covering an area the size of Connecticut. More than a million tourists come here every year to glimpse lion, giraffe, and elephant.
There is some elephants. I see some tracks in the corner here that come in.
Dr. Sam Ferreira is an ecologist with South African National Parks. He leads me to a clearing next to a man-made lake.
This is a big guy, and as you can see, there's lots of trees broken around us.
Elephant herds linger here, trampling the underbrush and pushing over trees to get at the tender leaves on top. A generation ago, park managers thought they could help animals by installing man-made watering holes. But it changed migration patterns. Elephants no longer roam long distances to get water. They just hang out here, and they're breeding rapidly. To manage their impact, the South African government's response includes elephant birth control and resettlement, but it also allows for culling, shooting and killing entire herds. Private wildlife ranchers and some conservation groups endorse South Africa's new policy. They point out that elephants leave a huge ecological footprint and that threatens the natural habitats of other species, like birds and sable antelope.
So now we have a situation where you've got too many animals in a defined space.
Gary Vandenberg is head of Wildlife Ranching South Africa. He's also an advocate of sustainable use, an approach to conservation that sees wildlife not just as animals, but as participants in an economic survival of the fittest. Elephants need resources, water, food, and lots of land to roam. But they're also moneymakers. They draw tourists and hunters to nature reserves.
Suddenly you're bringing income, you're bringing people to these remote areas.
Supporters of sustainable use say it's okay to kill a few animals if it means generating income for wildlife conservation. Their mantra is, if it pays, it stays. They say otherwise there's too much pressure on parkland to convert it for other use, like farming or housing. Some animal rights activists say this economic bottom line now drives South Africa's entire wildlife management policy. Louise Joubert is founder of the Sanwild Wildlife Trust.
We have gradually seen the emphasis shifting from conservation to blatant commercialization, and every single animal in South Africa has a commercial value on its head.
For elephants, that commercial value includes the sum of its parts, meat, skin, and ivory. For years, South Africa has pushed to reopen a legitimate ivory trade, and critics say that's the true aim of South Africa's policy, to generate revenue streams rather than protect biodiversity. Michelle Pickover of Animal Rights Africa disagrees with claims that there are too many elephants in South Africa's nature reserves.
The bottom line is a live elephant brings in much more money in a much more sustainable way than a dead one.
In Kruger National Park, female elephants and their calves tread slowly into a canopy of bush willow trees looking for food. Ecologist Sam Ferreira's priority is to manage these elephants' impact on the landscape, not just kill them to bring down numbers. He says the continent is watching how South Africa manages its elephant population.
South Africa is a leader in Africa, whether it is in an economic sense or whether it is in conservation sense. A lot of the stuff that we do out here, people will follow.
And that's important because this controversy goes beyond elephants. Tensions between capitalism and conservation will only grow as human populations push up against wild places. In Kruger National Park, South Africa, I'm Gretchen Wilson for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, getting back to the ways consumers are dealing with their own economic troubles, no matter what the GDP numbers say. A survey out from the research firm NPD says higher food prices have boosted sales of freezers, the big ones you keep down in the garage or down in the basement. The logic goes something like this. Food prices are rising, so more of us are buying in bulk, which means we need someplace to put it, which means freezer sales are up 7% so far this year. Other home appliance sales, by the way, down 8%. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Thursday afternoon. Today, the Dow bounced up 212 points, 1.8%. The NASDAQ climbed 29 points, 1.25%. The S&P 500 put on 18 points, 1.4%. Kevin Arnovitz, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, St. Paul gets its day in the sun.
Minnesota is such an exceptional place that you hate to say that it's average in anything.
There's probably something. We'll tell you about it tomorrow. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.